Mr. Brent Perry is also here. He represents the appellant, Ruling Ming. We're dividing our time. I'm going to take about 10 minutes to discuss the latches issues. Mr. Perry will address the equitable estoppel issues and any rebuttal argument. The issues I'd like to talk about generally would fall into about three or four categories. First, I'd like to address the standard of review very briefly. Then the critical issue of the case, which is what does claim mean with respect to a claim under 35 U.S.C. Section 256. Then I would like to urge the court to look very carefully at its holding in Advanced Cardiovascular versus SciMed Life case, reiterate that holding and affirm that holding. And then if time permits, I'll take a brief look at the prejudice issue.
If time is short, I encourage you to start with your most significant issue.
Right. With respect to the standard of review, very briefly, I address it because I think the district court has confused the standards of review here. They talk about both standards of review, but this case was on motion for summary judgment. So we're entitled to the regular summary judgment standard of review that all evidence must be viewed in the light most favorable to the non-movement and that we're entitled to all reasonable inferences. There's also the abuse of discretion standard of review for a latches case, but that standard of review should only apply after the factors which are required to establish latches have actually been proven on the record. Those, of course, would be the unreasonable delay and prejudice. I think the critical issue in this case and where the district court went wrong was in its conclusion as to what a claim means. And for purposes of Section 256 and as used for determining the period of delay, the district court stated that a claim is a general claim of inventorship. First of all, I think this is a rewrite of Section 256. A claim under Section 256 applies to correction of an issued patent. Obviously,
counsel, your client apparently waited 20 years before asserting a claim of inventorship, and that's well beyond the typical or the requirement of delay of no more than 6 years under applicable cases. Why should we find that 20 years is applicable in this case?
Because under Section
256, that does not constitute latches.
Because under Section 256, his claim does not even accrue until the patent is issued. There are many cases, several cases that we've cited in our brief, which hold that the court does not even have jurisdiction to consider a Section 256 claim until the patent is issued. That is,
district court seems to have suggested, I mean, you know, you could have filed a 116 motion or an interference, right?
Right.
Which all ran before the 256 claim, right?
Correct.
Is that what your read is, that the district court...
The district court looks at other possible remedies that we might have had. And in doing that, it relies on the Moore v. Broadcom case very heavily, which is an unreported case out of California.
Doesn't the court do that because those processes gave notice to your client on the issue of inventorship, that somebody else was asserting inventorship, the inventorship did not include your clients?
The problem with that is that if Dr. Hoare had tried to do something under Section 116, it requires consent of the other inventors and of the assignee. There's no indication in the record whatsoever that he could have possibly obtained consent. And I would submit that from the evidence that is in the record, there's a very reasonable inference that he would have never gotten consent from Dr. Chu or from the University of Houston. They've opposed him at every turn.
Could he not file an inference?
If he had filed his own patent claim, is that what you're suggesting on that, to provoke an interference, correct?
Or an interference as to the issue of inventorship.
Right. That would have required him to file his own patent claim, claiming that he was the sole inventor, as I understand it. And that has never been his claim. His claim has never been that he was the sole inventor. His claim has always been a claim of co-inventorship.
So can I, you know, we've got to decide this case and we've got to construe the law, and there's not that much out there with regard to this question. Is it your view that you should prevail here because we have that we reach the question of whether or not he could have and therefore should have filed a 116 or an interference? Or is your view, even if he were eligible to file it, even if he could have filed it, even if there's suggestion that other people would have agreed, that doesn't matter under your interpretation of 256?
I think that's my first argument, yes. It doesn't, under my interpretation of 256, it does not matter. And I think that is supported by the court's opinions in Advanced Cardiovascular and Stark. In Advanced Cardiovascular, I don't often quote an oral argument, but I think this is important here. Advanced Cardiovascular says, a delay of more than 6 years after the date the omitted inventor knew or should have known of the issuance of a patent will produce a rebuttable presumption of latches. So in Advanced Cardiovascular, the court very specifically ties the issue of latches to the date of the issuance of the patent. It does that based somewhat on the holding in Aukerman, which is an infringement case, which also holds that latches cannot begin to apply until the date of the issuance of the patent.
But let me ask you, why is a kind of policy rather than a legal matter, should that be the case?
Well,
if you've got latches, you've got the same prejudice to the other side. It's still taken 20 years. And if your client, assuming that your client knew or should have known that the application had been filed and it was proceeding before the PTO, why should we not include that as an equitable matter?
Because I think that is essentially a rewrite of Section 256. I think that is the major problem with that. As a matter of policy, perhaps that's correct. Perhaps that is the correct policy. But 256 says what it says, and the cases interpreting 256 say what they say. And I look at Advanced Cardiovascular and the first opinion in Stark particularly. And they both, Stark itself follows that language in 256, from Advanced Cardiovascular, and it says, the general rule is that latches period does not accrue until each patent issues, even if the patents are interrelated. They were dealing with separate patents in those cases. But again, you have two cases here basically very, very clearly saying period of latches begins when patent issues. I think a litigant and their attorneys, for that matter, are entitled to rely on those statements and rely on the plain language of Section 256 with respect to issued patent and the cases that say don't even have a claim, no jurisdiction whatsoever unless there is an issued patent.
Following up on these policy considerations, if we start with the statute beginning when the patent issues, and in situations like this where there's a long period of time, are we putting all the weight on a particular inventor or an individual to process a patent, to bear the expense, to go through the entire process, allowing others to sit back and wait, not participate in any of that, to see if the patent issues, and then jump in and assert co-inventorship?
That would seem to go to the material prejudice issue. And material prejudice was not an issue in this particular case. The prejudice issue, as determined by the district court, was based solely on evidentiary prejudice. I agree you could have situations like that. That is not the situation in this particular case because both Dr. Chu and Dr. Hoare worked for the University of Houston. Under the University of Houston's policy, they are required to assign their patents to the University of Houston. So the University of Houston, in this instance, is going to do what it's going to do with respect to pursuing the patent application or any interferences, regardless of whether it's one of their professors who invented it or two or three or more of their professors. So that issue is not really present in this case. I agree it could be present in other cases. What we did have here was the district court's review of the prejudice element of the latches doctrine. And if you look at the district court opinion, it gives very short shrift to the prejudice element, a couple of paragraphs. My contention is that our rebuttal evidence, assuming the presumption of latches does apply for the moment, which I'm not conceding, but assuming it does and that we were required to come forth with rebuttal evidence, Our rebuttal evidence on the lack of evidentiary prejudice I thought was extremely strong, and the district court completely discounts any of it. And in fact, one of the reasons I talked about the standard of review at the beginning was if you look at the way the district court looked at the evidence of prejudice, one of the things it talks about is Robert Hazen, who is a scientist here in Washington, D.C. with the National Geophysical Lab, I believe, who actually determined what the chemical structure and the crystalline structure of the compound at issue was. And it makes one quote from a letter of his that says, "My memory is completely faded." What it fails to take into account, though, is that Dr. Hazen wrote a book about the very events in question here. I've never had a case before in which there was actually a book written about the facts of the case. Dr. Hazen wrote a book about the case. We had 16, 17, 18 boxes of his notes from that book, his interviews with Dr. Chu. The book was based largely on his interviews with Dr. Chu. And Dr. Chu's counsel thought he was important enough that we traveled up here to D.C. to take his deposition for 8 hours one day. And his recollection was remarkably strong. So with respect to evidentiary prejudice, I think that was one factor that shows how the court really gave a short shrift. The other factors on evidentiary prejudice that I hope the court would look at would be the fact that we have all the lab notebooks from this period, thousands and thousands of pages of lab records detailing all the chemical compositions and the tests and everything. We also have the
just to try and get to the point which I find most troubling about all of this, I'm inclined to agree that the plain reading of Section 256 is that until you have a patent, you have nothing to complain about. There's no point in saying that I invented this unpatentable subject matter, because the issue just doesn't evolve under 256. But it isn't just that there were all of these records. There were all of the affidavits, assertions, statements, sworn statements against interest, contrary to the positions which are now taking. There's nothing that says that latches, an equitable document, can't come into effect until 6 years after issuance has taken place. And it seemed to me that all of these factors were taken into account by the district court in thinking that whatever it is, you waited too long.
With respect to my client in particular, there are two things that the district court points to. One, that there was a meeting with the patent attorney in which the pair of hands comment came up. My client left because he was upset. And Dr. Chu assures him he's going to go back and straighten out things with the attorney. I think my client is entitled to rely on his collaborator, his mentor, in telling him what he's going to do with respect to the patent.
Indeed, if that were the only event, but the record before us and the briefs point to all sorts of interactions that took place during the interference, during the pendency, during the questions by the university.
With respect to my client, I think there's only one other event, and Mr. Perry can address, you know, some of the events with respect to Ms. Ming. But with respect to Dr. Hoare, there's only one other event that the court talks about, and that is an affidavit that he provided in the interference proceeding, in which he says, during a discussion in December of 1986, I believe, he discussed this subject with Dr. Wu from the University of Alabama, which was completely consistent with what Dr. Hoare believed his role was, and completely consistent with his own belief that he was a co-inventor. I see that I'm down on time. I would like to reserve some for Mr. Perry.
I think that we better hear from your colleague.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. This court has said...
No, please come over here so it's recorded.
I apologize. I'm trying not to waste my time. This court has said that correction of inventorship should be liberally available at any time during the life of the patent. In this case, we've created a standard where correction of inventorship is never available once the patent is issued. As such, this violates the court's prior pronouncements.
I don't recall that. Saying that once the patent is out, that's it?
Well, that's the situation we have here. If latches runs before the patent ever issues, then judicial review of inventorship is never available.
On a unique set of circumstances, it seems, at least unusual.
Yes, Your Honor. I was taught in law school that hard cases make bad law. And this case, this was a situation where the patent took 19 years to issue. The evidence in the factual evidence in the record is that the minute we found out that our clients found out that they were not inventors, they complained, they asked for review, they made presentations to the university, and the period following the patent issuance was a continued investigation, and when they refused to do an investigation, we filed a lawsuit. Had the standard been that the minute the patent issued, we had to file a lawsuit, that could have been done, but this court's prior pronouncements say that the lawsuit doesn't have to be filed, or that a presumption against you does not arise as long as you sue within 6 years after the patent issues.
Isn't this why we have the reason to know or should have known standard in Latches?
Yes, Your Honor, but the court's prior pronouncements on this issue, particularly advanced cardiovascular, say that that standard does not apply until the patent issues. It's very clear that the standard is that it begins on the later of when the patent issues or when you knew or should have known. And the court in this case, if the court wants me to talk about equitable estoppel, I will, but the court in this case made all the inferences against our clients. The evidence is far more disputed than the court's opinion suggests, and the dispute was out in the open between the parties the day the patent issued. Additionally, there was a patent that issued during the pendency of this lawsuit that directly relates to this, and claims were filed on that patent almost as soon as it was issued. The court's law on equitable estoppel is very thin, really not going much beyond Aukerman, which was a patent infringement case. But the court says that the plaintiff has to engage in some misleading conduct, which suggests that they have abandoned their claim, or that the only possible inference from their conduct is that they don't intend to be an inventor. There's no evidence of that sort in this case. Finally, the reliance, there is no evidence of reliance in this case, in that U of H or Dr. Chu have done anything other than just prosecute a patent. They've not built the plant, as this court suggested in Aukerman, on the idea that they had all the benefits of the patent rather than just half of it or two-thirds of it. So there's no evidence of reliance. And there's also, as my co-counsel talked about, there's no evidence of material harm, prejudice, economic or evidentiary prejudice. The particularly with Dr. Chu, all we are seeking is a share of the inventor's revenue if we are named an inventor, and Dr. Chu has not suffered any prejudice as a result of this, because he hasn't paid for the patent to be prosecuted, and he hasn't paid to build the plant or anything like that.
Thank you. Let's hear from the other side, and we'll save you rebuttal time.
Thank you.
Mr. Hewitt.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. This is a classic Latches and estoppel case. This is a classic case of equity. This is a classic case where all the evidence is so old, much of it is disintegrated with time.
Yeah, but the question before us, I mean, you may be right about that. We've got the statute before us, and the statute speaks only to an issued patent. So how do you avoid the clear edict of the statute?
I'm sorry, I didn't understand.
256 talks about an issued patent.
Right.
And the conclusion here in terms of Latches and equitable estoppel means that the other side here was compelled to bring the 256 action before the patent issued. How is that not bumping up against the clear statute?
Your Honor, with respect to inventorship, under the law we have 116 and we have the interference rules, both of which apply before the patent issues. 116 allows a proceeding in the patent office. What Mr. Beverly has said is that's of no merit because the U of H would never have agreed to it. because the U of A...
I want to talk about 256, if you don't mind.
All right.
They want to bring a 256. The argument is they should have brought it while the patent was, the application was pending before the office.
I agree with you. They cannot bring a 256 action until the patent issues.
So why, with respect to the 256 action, would we hold against them the failure to bring an action before the patent issued, where we all recognize that they couldn't have brought that action?
Because a claim of inventorship is never contemporaneous with the issuance of the patent. Inventorship is made long before the patent issues. Inventorship typically dates back a reasonable amount of time before the patent issues.
Okay,
so
but
whenever,
I thought you, but with respect to a 256 action, I'm sure I'm missing something here, but
whenever,
how could they bring that before the patent issue?
No.
No, okay.
They cannot. But in order to prove it, in order to prove inventorship, they must rely upon actions historical to the issuance of the patent.
Okay. But that's not the point. I agree with Judge Prost. 256 is clearly stated. And so the question before us, the only question basis on which it was decided, was latches.
Your Honor,
not
you're,
proof, but latches.
You're exactly correct. It is an equitable case. But what I'm saying is equitable is based upon, of course, sleeping on rights. That's what latches is about.
How could they sleep on their right to bring an action that they had no right to bring?
They did have a right to bring a claim of inventorship.
Unlike
they didn't have a right to bring a claim of inventorship under 256.
On what basis are you saying they had a right to bring a claim of inventorship of a patent that had never issued?
I'm saying they had a right to bring a claim of inventorship under 116 or through an interference practice.
116 is by agreement.
I agree with that. And so 116 may not have been the best path, but certainly interference was. There were multiple interferences with respect to this patent application.
Well, are you saying they had to have filed the patent application in order to bring it?
Certainly.
You're saying they had to say they were the sole inventor? How else could they have filed an interfering application other than to say this is my invention? They've never said that. They said that they contributed and participated.
That's exactly right. And I believe that you can make a claim for co-inventorship in an interference proceeding.
I've never seen it. Let me ask you another question, because it's a basic question which is bothering me. Even on the position that you take, that they could not bring a 256 action, any defendant in any infringement suit can challenge the correctness of inventorship. I have great trouble understanding why the university is working so hard, debating so vigorously to preserve an inventorship situation which, whether or not they win or not, can be seriously challenged. That makes no sense. That makes even less sense to me than the rest of these events which have transpired. Why would the university want a patent so subject to challenge and potential invalidity on its face?
The university believes, and of course we represent Dr. Chu, but the university is supporting this. Dr. Chu believes, and we believe all the evidence will show and has shown, that he is the sole inventor.
The record states that the university declined the recommendation of their committee that they hold some sort of evidentiary something or other and decide the inventorship issue.
The university did do that. I agree with that.
The record says that they did not.
I'm sorry?
The briefs say that they declined to do that.
They did. I agree with that. They did. But my understanding was they were declined not because of the merits, but it was because of the lack of knowledge in this issue of law to make any kind of decision.
You want three strangers to decide instead?
Well, I think that the courts and lawyers especially steeped in intellectual property law are the right people to do it rather than university professors or university employees who are not understanding of patent law and patents. The question of the right forum for inventorship was through 116 through interference or 256. The problem we have here is that from the very beginning...
But they chose 256. And you say the 256 is not available because it's not available. And if we were to conclude that 116 is not available on its face, it's not available, you have to agree that there was joint invention under 116. Then what?
Then they still had the right, I believe, to bring it under interference. What they cannot do...
They'd have to swear that they're the sole inventor. They've never taken that position.
I'll take that to be the law. I believe in this case what I saw was in the Wu v. Chu interference, Wu actually alleged at the last minute...
Wu is not a party before us.
The record, I'm giving you the record here on the Wu v. Chu interference. Wu challenged Ming, as claimed that Ming was a joint inventor, and filed a brief to that effect at the last minute in that interference. And the Board of Appeals in the interference ruled that she was not a joint inventor. So they certainly considered the issue of joint inventorship, and that's in the record with respect to the Board of Appeals opinion.
What are the underpinnings for the conclusion you'd have us reach here? What in 256? 256 doesn't... I mean, you're asking us to state that your rights under 256 are limited. If you could have but didn't, or could have and should have filed a 116 or an interference, where is the basis for our reaching that kind of conclusion?
The basis is in equity. What has transpired here and what is before us is the situation where the claim is 20 years old, where people are arguing over events that occurred 20 years ago. What we're saying
suppose that they're looking at the statute, 256, and it says correction of named inventor, and they're aware that there may be an issue. Obviously, they're aware that there was an issue of inventorship. But yet they're looking at a statute that this court applies all the time, that here you have the authority in which to proceed to correct who's the inventor. Are you saying that by failing to file an interference, that 256 no longer applies?
No, I'm sorry, I'm not saying that. I think this is, the way I look at it, this is chronological with the events. That there was inventorship and filed applications. There was the availability of a 116 proceeding in the patent office. I'm not going to concede that the U of H would not have agreed.
So you're asking us to look at this in equity. If we look at this and they chose to follow the 256 path, presumably because they felt that was in their best interest for whatever reason, then how do we rule against that when Congress has provided us the basis upon which to determine co-inventorship issues?
Well, I'm not sure. There isn't any evidence they chose to wait for a 256 action. What they have claimed
the claim that they filed did come in within 6 years of the issuance of the patent.
Absolutely.
So they satisfy 256.
They satisfy the statute. What we're saying is, what the lower court said is, it doesn't satisfy the law with respect to latches, because the claim of inventorship, which could have come out as early as the Cox meeting. The Cox meeting is at the heart of this. The patent attorney sat down with Hoare and Chu and said, who invented yttrium? Neither of them raised their hand. Yet that is exactly part of the claim that they make today under Rule 256. Based upon that information, the fact that neither of them said they invented yttrium, and Dr. Chu said he did 20 years ago.
You say they have to lose on the merits, but the merits aren't before us.
I say they have to lose. You're correct. I say they have to lose on the latches and the estoppel issue. I'm sorry if I misspoke. So to get back to the meeting a minute, to set the stage, the patent attorney has the meeting with the potential inventors because there's already a pending interference. He has the meeting in 1988 or 1989 and says twice, who invented yttrium? And Dr. Chu raised his hand and said, Ru Ling Ming, remember I called you and told you that was my suggestion. The other two were silent. Dr. Chu said, well, they should both be inventors. Anyway, and Mr. Cox said, no, 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 a pair of hands cannot be an inventor. They knew at that moment that they were not considered inventors by Mr. Cox. As this court well knows, inventorship is not determined by agreement.
Yeah, the difficulty I'm having with your analysis is the other side isn't suggesting that you can't prove this up or even a latches defense. I understood this case as being about who gets the six-year presumption, who gets the presumption. Even if the presumption goes the other way under latches, it seems to me Dr. Chu would still be able to prove up unreasonable and inexcusable delay or prejudice. Those arguments wouldn't go away. It's simply a matter of you still get a latches defense. It's just a matter of who gets the six-year presumption, right?
Well, the six-year presumption comes from a finding of unreasonable delay.
Right.
As part of latches. The trial court found the call and dismissed their claim under 256.
Because the 6 years starts to run from the earlier time and not from the 256 filing, right?
Because the trial court said latches should be measured from the time they knew or should have known, which is the holding of Aukerman and was emphasized in Advanced Cardiovascular.
No, Aukerman was after the issuance of the patent. It was an infringement case.
That's right. But Aukerman set forth the principles of latches, and they were applied to 256 under Advance, but not under these facts, because there the knowledge of the patent came after the patent issue. So Aukerman, but what Aukerman did do is it distinguished between running it from the date the patent issued under constructive notice to actually when the claimant there knew or should have known. And so Advance.
All after the patent issued.
All after the patent issued, but Advance set the standard based upon latches. And that standard is what carries back for latches as to when these claimants knew or should have known that they had a claim of inventive rights.
Advance said you can't bring a 256 action until the patent issue.
You cannot. But if you wait on your rights through interferences, through a 116, through everything, waiting for the circumstances.
You don't have any rights to bring a 256 action until the patent issue.
I agree, Your Honor. And if I misspoke if I said that. What they could have done is give notice. They are claimants. They could have told Mr. Cox they're claimants. An evaluation would have been made. The evidence may have been much fresher at that time. Perhaps even the decision would have gone differently. We'll never know because they didn't. They withheld that information. So Mr. Cox, as the university attorney, an attorney for Dr. Chu, went forward, defended these interferences under the assumption that and understanding that Dr. Chu was the sole inventor.
Well, there's no question of ownership. I gather nobody's disputed that the university owns these patents.
It's not a matter of ownership. I agree. This is a matter, and you've seen it in some other cases before us here, Chow, for example, another case, where it's all about the royalty stream. This is a case about the royalty stream where the inventors are university employees, and if the patents become commercially successful, then the inventors, each inventor, gets some piece of that royalty stream. That's what this case is about. Dr. Chu now, because of this claim 20 years later, now is facing a claim against a royalty stream that he would have received the inventor's share of himself if he were the sole inventor, and now must be if the court were to ultimately find, would have to be split with others. So that's what that's about.
I can see problems arising if we adopt a constructive notice ruling on this. I don't see a problem if we were to say that 256 applies as long as you bring a claim within that period of time that latches does not apply. What's your problem with that view that I just espoused?
Because it would allow late claims.
What's the problem? I mean, the patent hasn't issued yet.
But sir, the inventorship has occurred. The inventorship has accrued. The evidence with respect to inventorship is back in history. Most of the time.
But we see that in a lot of our cases. Patents take time to, inventions take time to develop. We see that all the time. And in fact, we see where patents will issue 15 years ago and somebody will step forward later and assert under 256 the co-inventorship. What's the harm? I mean, if you don't have a patent that's issued, how can we say that the issue of inventorship has been settled?
There's always harm if the claim is so late that the evidence is stale. The evidence is disintegrating. That's the harm under the equity doctrines. And that's what the court ruling was below, based upon latches and estoppel. Equity applied. And while an action may very well, for inventorship under 256, may involve an inventorship that happened 3 years ago or 5 years ago, but it also might involve one like here 20 years ago, where the inventors knew or should have known they had an earlier claim they could have made known. And they didn't make it known. And so the university proceeded that entire time under the set of facts that Chu is undisputedly the sole inventor. And now they bring a 256 action. It can't start till the patent issues, but they could have taken these other steps first. So there's a continuum for the claim. And the fact is here, in this instance, because of the meeting with Cox and because of their exposure to the interferences, for all those reasons, they had every opportunity to say to the university, well, we think we're also inventors. And there could have been some informal investigation. They could have even ended up with a 116. Mr. Beverly says it would never happen. You know, we don't know that. But I would have to agree more likely than not, based upon what we've seen, it probably would not have happened. But then there are, with due respect, I believe they still had some claim as co-inventor under the interference statutes. They had the opportunity to give notice to the university. So the university would know at that time, because they're in these interference positions, they had to be darn sure they had the right inventorship. Stale claims, sleeping on rights, conduct that was misleading by silence to let the university go forward for years without any of this knowledge of this claim.
Mr. Hewitt, we are over time. I think we have the arguments for your questions.
Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Perry, is it your turn?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
I'll be brief. This, I don't have any choice but to be brief.
We'll enlarge your time a bit. We ran over with Mr. Hewitt. Let's make it 5 minutes to start.
Thank you, Your Honor. If this court holds in this case that latches can begin to run before the patent issues, then that applies to every case. The question is, who is going to be penalized for the fact that this patent issued took 19 years to issue? The statute does not allow that. This court said in Advanced Cardiovascular that the period of delay is measured from the date the omitted inventor knew or should have known of the issuance of the patent. If this patent had issued in 1989, based on the evidence, based on the record the court has before it, Ruling Ming and Pei Hung Or would have immediately disputed inventorship, just as they are entitled to under 256. Had the patent issued in 1993, the same would have happened. That was when they had a right, it vested in them, and they filed their claim within 6 years of the patent, within 6 years of the issuance, and they're entitled to the presumptions benefiting them in determining latches. The court in this case did not give them that presumption, and the court's summary judgment should be reversed. With regard to equitable estoppel, there is no evidence. There's evidence of disputed conduct, but if you take even the Cox meeting that Mr. Hewitt speaks about, you have Dr. Chu.
I thought the point on equitable estoppel was that the district court sua sponte raised it and they hadn't alleged it.
That's a problem with it. But no one had alleged it. But the evidence, they now claim that there was conduct that suggested we had abandoned our claims. If you take even the Cox meeting that Mr. Hewitt talks about, the lead inventor, Dr. Chu, said to our clients, "You are inventors. I'll take care of this." He's the person we trusted, not Mr. Cox with Mr. Hewitt's law firm. We didn't trust the lawyer to make that determination. We trusted Dr. Chu to take care of that. That's disputed evidence. It's not evidence of a claim being abandoned or of knowing that they're not inventors. There was silence in their intervening period, but there's no duty to speak because our claim does not arise until the patent issues. And that's exactly what we did in this case. There's no case where Dr. Orr or Ms. Ming said, "We don't want to be inventors. We're willing to relinquish our rights for the betterment of the university or for the betterment of Dr. Chu." Nothing like that happened, and that's the kind of conduct that you have to have in order to find equitable estoppel. You also have to have reliance. The court has said that reliance is an essential element, and there is no evidence in the record of anything Dr. Chu or his attorneys did other than defend a patent in the normal course of business. I don't have anything further unless the court has questions for me.
Thank you, Mr. Perry. Mr. Beverly, is there anything else you want to tell us?
Very briefly. With respect to the 116 issue, I think the evidence is very clear that the statute, the implementing regulation, requires consent. And if you look at the district court's opinion and where it talks about 116, it refers to the Moore case, the Moore versus Broadcom case. In the Moore versus Broadcom case, the district court there assumed that there was a requirement of diligence in pursuing a 116 claim based on the implementing regulation, 37 CFR 1.48. It was a complete misreading of that because the diligence requirement under the CFR had been taken out years before the Moore case came down. So if you look at the district court's opinion in this case, when it talks about 116, it talks about it in context of what Moore read, how Moore read 116 as applying. And there's no express diligence requirement. And that is the underpinning of Moore, is why Moore says, well, there's a diligence requirement in 116, so we will interpolate that to include a diligence requirement in 256, and therefore we can kind of combine these periods together. The Moore court was completely wrong on that, and the district court simply followed along. With respect to the interference proceeding, there's never been a claim here that they were the sole inventors. In order to do the interference proceeding, they would have had to claim sole inventorship. They did not. That has never been their claim, so that is not our case. Okay. Any questions?
Thank you.
Thank you.
Any questions? All right, thank you.